A British sailor appears in the open hatchway.
Sir,
he announces.
Another U-boat has been sighted in the area.
I'd love to have a stethoscope, Waterhouse hints. This thing have a sick bay?
No,
says the British officer.
Just a box of medical gear. Should be floating around somewhere.
Sir, yes, sir,
Shafto says, and vanishes from the room. A minute later, he's back, holding a German stethoscope up above his head to keep it clean. He tosses it across the cabin to Waterhouse, who snares it in the air, sockets it into his ears, and thrusts the business end down through the sewage to the front of the safe. He has done a little of this before as an exercise. Kids who are obsessed with locks frequently turn into adults who are obsessed with crypto. The manager of the grocery store in Moorhead, Minnesota, used to let young Waterhouse play with his safe. He broke the combination, to the manager's great surprise, and wrote a report about the experience for school. This safe is a lot better than that one was. Since he can't see the dial anyway, he closes his eyes. He is vaguely conscious that the other fellows on the submarine have been shouting and carrying on about something for a while, as if some sensational news has just come in. Perhaps the war is over. Then the head of the stethoscope is wrenched loose from his grasp. He opens his eyes to see Sergeant Shafto lifting it to his mouth as if it were a microphone. Shafto stares at him coolly and speaks into the stethoscope.
Sir, torpedoes in the water, sir.
Then Shafto turns and leaves Waterhouse alone in the cabin. Waterhouse is about halfway up the conning tower ladder, looking up at a disk of grayish-black sky, when the whole vessel jerks and booms. A piston of sewage rises up beneath him and propels him upwards, vomiting him out onto the top deck of the boat, where his comrades grab him and very considerately prevent him from rolling off into the ocean. The movement of the U-553 with the waves has changed. She's moving a lot more now, as if she's about to break free from the reef. It takes Waterhouse a minute to get his bearings. He is starting to think he may have suffered some damage during all of that. Something is definitely wrong with his left arm, which is the one he landed on. Powerful lights sweep over them. A searchlight from the British corvette that brought them here. The British sailors curse. Waterhouse levers himself up on his good elbow and sights down the hull of the U-boat, following the beam of the searchlight to a bizarre sight. The boat has been blown open just beneath the waterline. Shards of her hull peeled back from the wound and projecting jaggedly into the air. The foul contents of the hull are draining out, staining the Atlantic black.
Fuck!
Sergeant Shafto says. He shrugs loose from a small but heavy-looking knapsack that he's been carrying around, pulls it open. His sudden activity draws the attention of the Royal Navy men who help out by pointing their flashlights at his furious hands. Waterhouse, who may be in some kind of delirium by this point, can't quite believe what he sees. Shafto has pulled out a bundle of neat brownish-yellow cylinders, as thick as a finger and maybe 6 inches long. He also takes out some small items, including a coil of thick, stiff red cord. He jumps to his feet so decisively that he nearly knocks someone down and runs to the conning tower and disappears down the ladder.
Jesus,
an officer says.
He's going to do some blasting.
The officer thinks about this for a very small amount of time. The ship moves terrifyingly with the waves and makes scraping noises which might indicate it's sliding off the reef.
Abandon ship!
He hollers. Most of them get into the whaler. Waterhouse is bundled back onto the trolley contraption. He is about halfway across to the torpedo boat when he feels, but scarcely hears, a sharp shock. For the rest of the way over, he can't really see diddly, and even after he's back on the torpedo boat, all is confusion, and someone named Enoch Root insists on taking him below and working on his arm and his head. Waterhouse did not know until now that his head was damaged, which stands to reason, in that your head is where you know things, and if it's damaged, how can you know it?
You'll at least get a purple heart for this, Enoch Root says.
He says it with a marked lack of enthusiasm, as if he couldn't care less about purple hearts, but is condescending to suppose that it will be a big thrill for Waterhouse.
And Sergeant Shafto probably has another major decoration coming too, damn him.
Morphium. Shafto still sees the word every time he closes his eyes. It would be a lot better if he were paying attention to the work at hand, packing demolition charges around the gussets that join the safe to the U-boat. Morphium. It is printed thus on a yellowed paper label. The label is glued to a small glass bottle. The color of the glass is the same deep purple that you see when your eyes have been dazzled by a powerful light. Harvey, the sailor who has volunteered to help him, keeps shining his flashlight into Shafto's eyes. It is unavoidable. Shafto is wedged into a surpassingly awkward position beneath the safe, working with the charges, trying to set the primers with slimy fingers drained of warmth and strength. This would not even be possible if the boat hadn't been torpedoed. Before, this cabin was half full of sewage and the safe was immersed in it. Now it has been conveniently drained. Harvey is not wedged into anything. He is being flung around by the paroxysms of the U-boat, which, like a beached shark, is trying stupidly but violently to thrash its way loose from the reef. The beam of his flashlight keeps sweeping across Shafto's eyes. Shafto blinks and sees a cosmos of purple. Tiny purple bottles labeled morphium.
God damn it!
He hollers. Is everything all right, Sergeant? Harvey says. Harvey doesn't get it. Harvey thinks that Shafto is cursing at some problem with the explosives. The explosives are just fucking great. There's no problem with the explosives. The problem is with Bobby Shafto's brain.
He was right there.
Waterhouse sent him to find a stethoscope, and Shafto went chambering through the U-boat until he found a wooden box. He opened it up and saw right away it was full of medic stuff. He pawed through it, looking for what Waterhouse wanted, and there was the bottle plain as day right in front of his face.
His hand brushed against it, for God's sake.
He saw the label as the beam of his flashlight swept across it. Morphium. But he didn't grab it. If it had said morphine, he would have grabbed it in a second. But it said morphium. And it wasn't until about 30 seconds later that he realized that this was a fucking German boat, and of course the words would be all different, and there was about a 99% chance that morphium was, in fact, exactly the same stuff as morphine. When he realized that, he planted his feet in the passageway of the darkened U-boat and let out a deep, long scream from way down in his gut. With the noise of the waves, no one heard him. Then he continued onwards and carried out his duty, handing over the stethoscope to Waterhouse. He carried out his duty because he is a Marine. Blowing this fucking safe off the wall is not his duty. It's just an idea that popped into his head. They've been training him how to use these explosives. Why not put it into practice? He's blowing this safe up, not because he is a Marine, but because he is Bobby Shafto, and also because it's a great excuse to go back for that morphium. The U-boat bucks and sends Harvey sprawling to the deck. Shafto waits for the motion to subside, then flails for handholds and pulls himself out from under the safe. His weight is mostly on his feet now, but it wouldn't be correct to say he's standing up. In this place, the best you can hope for is to scramble for balance somewhat faster than you are falling on your keister. Harvey has just lost that race, and Shafto is winning it, for the moment.
Fire in the hole!
Shafto hollers. Harvey finds his feet. Shafto gives him a helpful shove out into the passageway. Harvey turns left and heads uphill for the conning tower and the exit. Shafto turns right. He heads downhill. Towards the bow. Towards Davy Jones's locker. Towards the box with the morphium. Where the fuck is that box? When he found it before, it was bobbing in the soup. Maybe. Horrible thought. Maybe it just drained out of the hole made by the torpedo. He passes through a couple of bulkheads. The boat's angle is getting steeper all the time, and he ends up walking backwards like he's descending a ladder, making handholds out of pipes, electrical cables, and the chains that suspend the submarine's bunks. This boat is so damn long. It seems like a strange way to kill people. Shafto's not sure if he approves of everything that is implied by this U-boat. Shafto has killed Chinese bandits on the banks of the Yangtze by stabbing them in the chest with a bayonet. He thinks he killed one once just by hitting him pretty hard in the head. On Guadalcanal, he killed Nips by shooting at them with several different kinds of arms, by rolling rocks down on them, by by constructing large bonfires at the entrances to caves where they were holed up, by sneaking up on them in the jungle and cutting their throats, by firing mortars into their positions, even by picking one up and throwing him off a cliff into the pounding surf. Of course, he has known for a long time that this face-to-face style of killing the bad guys is kind of old-fashioned, but it's not like he spent a lot of time thinking about it. The demonstration of the Vickers machine gun that he witnessed in Italy did sort of get him thinking, and now here he is inside one of the most famous killing machines in the whole war, and what does he see? He sees valves. Or rather, the cast iron wheels that are used for opening and closing valves. Entire bulkheads are covered with iron wheels, ranging from a couple of inches to over a foot in diameter, packed in as densely as barnacles on a rock in what looks like a completely random and irregular fashion. They are painted either red or black, and they are polished to a gleam from the friction of men's hands. And where it's not valves, it's switches. Huge Frankenstein movie ones. There is one big rotary switch, half green and half red, that's a good 2 feet in diameter. And it's not like this boat has a lot of windows in it. It's got no windows at all. Just a periscope that can only be used by one guy at a time. And so, for these guys, the war comes down to being sealed up in an airtight drum full of shit and turning valve wheels and throwing switches on command, and from time to time maybe some officer comes back and tells them that they just killed a bunch of guys. There's that box. It ended up on a bunk. Shafto yanks it closer and hauls it open. The contents are all jumbled up, and there's more than one purple bottle in there, and he panics for a moment, thinking he'll have to read all of the labels in their creepy Germanic script. But in a few seconds, he finds the morphium, grabs it, pockets it. He's on his way back up towards the conning tower when a big roller slams into the outside of the boat and knocks him off balance. He tumbles downhill for a long, long ways, doing backward somersaults straight down the middle of the boat, before he gets himself under control. Everything has gone black. He's lost his flashlight. He comes very close to panicking now. It's not that he's a panicky guy, just that it's been a while since he had morphine, and when he gets this way, his body reacts badly to things. He's half blinded by a powerful flash of blue light that is gone before his eyes have time to blink. There's a sizzling noise down below. He moves his left hand and feels a tug on his wrist. The flashlight's lanyard, which he had the presence of mind to wrap around himself. The light scrapes and clanks against the steel grating on which Shafto is now spread-eagled, like a saint on the gridiron. There's another flash of blue light, reticulated by black lines accompanied by a sizzling noise. Shafto smells electricity. He wraps the flashlight against the grating a couple of times, and it comes on again, flickeringly. The grid's woven from pencil-thick rods spaced a couple of inches apart. He's face down on it, looking into a hold that, if this U-boat were level, would be below him. The hold is a disaster. Its neatly stacked and crated contents now osterized into a slum gullion of shattered glass, splintered wood, foodstuffs, high explosives, and strategic minerals, all mingled with seawater so that it sloshes back and forth with the rocking of the dead U-boat. A perfect, quivering globe of silver falls through the grating right near his head and descends through his flashlight beam and explodes against a piece of debris. Then another. He looks uphill and sees a rain of silver globules bouncing and rolling down the deck plates toward him. The mercury columns that they used to measure pressure must have been ruptured. There's another blinding blue flash, an electrical spark with a lot of power behind it. Shafto looks down through the grid again and perceives that the hold is filled with huge metal cabinets with giant bolts sticking out of them. Every so often, a piece of wet debris will bridge the gap between a couple of those bolts, and a spark will light the place up. The cabinets are batteries. They are what enable the U-boat to run underwater. As Sergeant Robert Shafto lies there with his face pressed against that chilly grid, taking a few deep breaths and trying to regain his nerve, a big wave rocks the boat back so hard that he's afraid he's going to fall backwards and plummet all the way to the submerged bow. The swill in the battery hold rolls downhill, gathering power and velocity as it falls, and batters the forward bulkhead of the hold with terrifying power. He can hear rivets giving way under the impact. As this happens, most of the battery hold is exposed to the beam of Bobby Shafto's flashlight all the way down to the bottom. And that is when he sees the splintered crates down there. Very small crates, such as might be used to contain very heavy supplies. They have been busted open. Through the gaps in the wreckage, Shafto can see yellow bricks, once neatly stacked, now scattered. They look exactly like he would imagine gold bars. The only thing wrong with that theory is that there are way too many of them down there for them to be gold bars. It is like when he turned over rotten logs in Wisconsin and found thousands of identical insect eggs sown on the dark earth, glowing with promise. For a moment, he is tempted. The amount of money down there is beyond calculation. If he could get his hands on just one of those bars... The explosives must have detonated because Bobby Shafto has just gone deaf. That's his cue to get the fuck out of here. He forgets about the gold. Morphine's good enough plunder for one day. He half scrambles and half climbs up the grid, up the passageway, up the skipper's cabin, smoke pouring out of its hatch, its bulkheads now weirdly ballooned by the blast wave. The safe has broken loose, and the cable that he and Harvey attached to it, though it's damaged, is still intact. Someone must be hauling away on it up above decks because it is stubbornly and annoyingly taut. Right now, the safe is caught up on jagged obstructions. Shafto has to pry it loose. The safe jerks onward and upward, drawn by the taut cable until it gets caught in something else. Shafto follows the safe out of the cabin, up the passageway, up the conning tower ladder, and finally levers himself up out of the submarine and into the teeth of the storm, to a hearty cheer from the waiting sailors. No more than 5 minutes later, the U-boat goes away. Shafto imagines it tumbling end over end down the side of the reef, headed for an undersea canyon, scattering gold bars and mercury globules into the black water like fairy dust. Shafto's back on the Corvette, and everyone is pounding him on the back and toasting him. He just wants to find a private place to open up that purple bottle. Suit. Randy's posture is righteous and alert. It is all because of his suit. It is trite to observe that hackers don't like fancy clothes. Abby has learned that good clothes can actually be comfortable. The slacks that go with a business suit, for example, are really much more comfortable than blue jeans, and he has spent enough time with hackers to obtain the insight that it is not wearing suits that they object to, so much as getting them on. Which includes not only the donning process per se, but also picking them out, maintaining them, and worrying whether they are still in style, this last being especially difficult for men who wear suits once every 5 years. So it's like this. Avi has a spreadsheet on one of his computers, listing the necks, inseams, and other vital measurements of every man in his employ. A couple of weeks before an important meeting, he will simply fax it to his tailor in Shanghai. Then, in a classic demonstration of the Asian just-in-time delivery system, as pioneered by Toyota, the suits will arrive via Federal Express 24 hours ahead of time so that they can be automatically piped to the hotel's laundry room. This morning, just as Randy emerged from the shower, he heard a knock at his door and swung it open to reveal a valet carrying a freshly cleaned and pressed business suit, complete with a shirt and tie. He put it all on. A 10th-generation photocopy of a bad diagram of the half Windsor knot was thoughtfully provided. It fit perfectly. Now he stands in the lobby of the Foot Mansion, watching electric numbers above an elevator count down, occasionally sneaking a glance at himself in a big mirror. Randy's head protruding from a suit is a sight gag that will be good for grins at least through lunchtime. He is pondering the morning's email. 2. dwarf@siblings.net From root@eruditorium.org. Subject, Re-Y. Dear Randy, I hope you don't mind if I address you as Randy, since it's quite obvious that you are you, despite your use of an anonymous front. This is a good idea, by the way. I applaud your prudence. Concerning the possibility that I am an old enemy of yours, I'm dismayed that one so young can already have old enemies. Or perhaps you are referring to a recently acquired enemy of advanced years. Several candidates come to mind, but I suspect you are referring to Andrew Loeb. I am not he. this would be obvious to you if you had visited his website recently. Why are you building the crypt? Signed, begin ordo signature block, etc., etc. End ordo signature block. It is not at all interesting to watch the numbers over the elevators and try to predict which one will arrive first, but it is more interesting than just standing there. One of them has been stuck on the floor above Randy's for at least a minute. He can hear it buzzing angrily. In Asia, many businessmen, especially some of the overseas Chinese, would think nothing of commandeering one of the hotel's elevators around the clock for their own personal use, stationing minions in it, in 8-hour shifts, to hold their thumbs on the door open button, ignoring its self-righteous alarm buzzer. Ding! Randy spins around on the balls of his feet. Just try that little maneuver in a pair of sneakers. Once again, he has backed the wrong horse. The winner is an elevator that was on the very top floor of the hotel last time he scanned it. This is an elevator with purpose, a fast-track lift. He walks toward the green light. The doors part. Randy stares squarely into the face of Dr. Hubert, the dentist, Kepler, DDS. Or perhaps you are referring to a recently acquired enemy of advanced years.
Good morning, Mr. Waterhouse. When you stand with your mouth open like that, you remind me of one of my patients.
Good morning, Dr. Kepler.
Randy hears his words from the other end of a mile-long bumwad tube, and immediately reviews them in his own mind to make sure he has not revealed any proprietary corporate information or given Dr. Kepler any reason to file a lawsuit. The doors start to close, and Randy has to whack them open with his laptop case.
Careful. That's an expensive piece of equipment, I'd wager, says the dentist.
Randy is about to say, I go through laptops like a transvestite goes through nylons.
Though maybe like a high-speed drill through a necrotic molar would be more thematically apropos, but instead he clams up and says nothing at all, finding himself in dangerous territory. He is carrying proprietary AVCLA information on this thing, and if the dentist gets the impression that Randy's being cavalier with it, he might spew out a barrage of torts like Linda Blair and the pea soup.
It's a pleasant surprise to see you in Kinakuta, Randy stammers.
Dr. Kepler wears eyeglasses the size of a 1959 Cadillac's windshield. They are special dentist eyeglasses, as polished as the Palomar mirror, coated with ultra-reflective material so that you can always see the reflection of your own yawning maw in them, impaled on a shaft of hot light. The dentist's own eyes merely haunt the background like a childhood memory. They are squinty gray-blue eyes, turned down at the edges as if he is tired of the world, with Stygian pupils. A trace of a smile always seems to be playing around his withered lips. It is the smile of a man who is worrying about how to meet his next malpractice insurance payment while patiently maneuvering the point of his surgical steel crowbar under the edge of your dead bicuspid, but who has read in a professional magazine that patients are more likely to come back and less likely to sue you if you smile at them.
"Say,"
he says, "I wonder if I could have a quick huddle with you sometime later." "Spit, please." Saved by the bell. They have reached the ground floor. The elevator doors open to reveal the endangered marble lobby of the Foot Mansion. Bellhops, disguised as wedding cakes, glide to and fro as if mounted on casters. Not 10 feet away is Avi, and with them are 2 beautiful suits from which protrude the heads of Eb and John. All 3 heads turn towards them. Seeing the dentist, Eb and John adopt the facial expressions of B-movie actors whose characters have just taken small-caliber bullets to the center of the forehead. Avi, by contrast, stiffens up like a man who stepped on a rusty nail a week ago and has just felt the first stirrings of the tetanus infection that will eventually break his spine.
We've got a busy day ahead of us, Randy says. I guess my answer is yes, subject to availability.
Good, I'll hold you to it, says Dr. Kepler, and steps out of the elevator. Good morning, Mr. Hallaby. Good morning, Dr. Furr. Good morning, Mr. Cantrell. Nice to see you all looking so very much like gentlemen.
Nice to see you acting like one.
The pleasure is ours, Abby says. I take it we'll be seeing you later?
Oh, yes, says the dentist. You'll be seeing me all day.
This procedure will be a lengthy one, I'm afraid. He turns his back on them and walks across the lobby without further pleasantries. He is headed for a cluster of leather chairs, nearly obscured by an explosion of bizarre tropical flowers. The occupants of those chairs are mostly young and all smartly dressed. They snap to attention as their boss glides towards them. Randy counts three women and two men. One of the men is obviously a gorilla, but the women, inevitably referred to as Fates, Furies, Graces, Norns, or Harpies, are rumored to have bodyguard training and to carry weapons, too.
Who are those?
John Cantrell asks.
His hygienists?
Don't laugh, Abby says. Back when he was in practice, he got used to having a staff of women do the pick and floss work for him. It shaped his paradigm.
Are you shitting me? Randy asks.
You know how it works, Abby says. When you go to the dentist, you never actually see the dentist, right? Someone else makes the appointment. Then there's always this elite coterie of highly efficient women who scrape the plaque out of the way so that the dentist doesn't have to deal with it and take your x-rays. The dentist himself sits in the back somewhere and looks at the x-rays. He deals with you as this abstract grayscale image on a little piece of film. If he sees holes, he goes into action. If not, he comes in and exchanges small talk with you for a minute and then you go home.
So why is he here? Demands Eberhard Fur.
Exactly, Abby says. When he walks into the room, you never know why he's here, to drill a hole in your skull or just talk about his vacation in Maui.
All eyes turn to Randy.
What went on in that elevator?
Nothing, Randy blurts.
Did you discuss the Philippines project at all?
He just said he wanted to talk to me about it.
Oh, shit, Abby says. That means we have to talk about it first.
I know that, Randy says. So I told him that I might talk to him if I had a free moment.
Well, we'd best make damn sure you have no free moments today, Abby says.
He thinks for a moment and continues. Did he have a hand in his pocket at any time?
Why, are you expecting him to pull out a weapon?
No,
Abby says.
But someone told me once that the dentist is wired.
You mean like a police informant?
John asks incredulously.
Yeah, Abby says. Like it's no big deal. He makes a habit of carrying a tiny digital recorder the size of a matchbook around in his pocket, perhaps with a wire running up inside his shirt to a tiny microphone somewhere. Perhaps not. Anyway, you never know when he's recording you.
Isn't that illegal or something?
Randy asks.
I'm not a lawyer, Abby says. More to the point, I'm not a Kinnikutin lawyer. But it wouldn't matter in a civil suit. If he slapped us with a tort, he could introduce any kind of evidence he wanted.
They all look across the lobby. The dentist is standing flat-footed on the marble, arms folded over his chest, chin pointed at the floor as he absorbs input from his aides.
He might have put his hand in his pocket. I don't remember, Randy says.
It doesn't matter. We kept it extremely general and brief.
He could still subject the recording to a voice stress analysis to figure out if you were lying,
John points out.
He relishes the sheer unbridled paranoia of this. He's in his element.
Not to worry, Randy says. I jammed it.
Jammed it? How?
Eb asks, not catching the irony in Randy's voice. Eb looks surprised and interested. It is clear from the look on his face that Eb longs to get into a conversation about something arcane and technical.
I was joking, Randy explains. If the dentist analyzes the recording, he'll find nothing but stress in my voice.
Abby and John laugh sympathetically, but Eb is crestfallen.
Oh, Eb says. I was thinking that we could absolutely jam his device if we so wanted.
A tape recorder doesn't use radio, John says. How could we jam it?
Van Eck freaking, Eb says.
At this point, Tom Howard emerges from the cafe with a thoroughly ravished copy of the South China Morning Post under his arm, and Beryl emerges from an elevator, prepped for combat in a dress and makeup. The men avert their eyes shyly and pretend not to notice. Greetings and small talk ensue. Then Abby looks at his watch and says,
"Let's head over to the Sultan's Palace."
As if he were proposing, they go grab some French fries at Mickey D's. Cracker. Waterhouse has to keep an eye on that safe.
Shafto is itching to blow it open with high explosives, and Chatton, who firmly overrules Shafto, intends to ship it back to London so that it can be opened by experts at the Broadway buildings. Waterhouse only wants to have another crack at opening it himself, just to see if he can do it. Chatton's position is the correct one. Detachment 2702 has a very clear and specialized mission, which most certainly does not include opening safes from U-boats. For that matter, it does not include going on to abandon U-boats to recover safes or other crypto data in the first place. The only reason they did that was because they happened to be the only people with ultra-clearance who were in the neighborhood, and U-553's precarious position did not give Bletchley Park time to send out its own experts. But Waterhouse's desire to open the safe himself has nothing to do with Detachment 2702's mission, or his own personal duties, or even, particularly, with winning the war. It is something that Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is driven to do. His is not to reason why. Even as he was reeling down that stretched line from U-553 to the torpedo boat, battered by waves and wind and rain, with a busted arm and a busted head, not knowing from one moment to the next whether he would make it back to the boat or plunge into the Atlantic, he was remembering the infinitesimal tremors picked up by the half-frozen neurons in his fingertips as he twiddled the safe's submerged dial. Even as Enoch Root patched him up on board the boat, Waterhouse was constructing a crude mental model of how the safe's tumblers might be constructed, visualizing the thing in his mind's eye. And even as the rest of Detachment 2702 collapses into their cots and hammocks and sleeping bags around the chapel of Tagum Castle, the splinted and bandaged Waterhouse stalks the polished corridors of that building's better corner, looking for a couple of used razor blades and a hunk of carbon. The razors he finds in a rubbish bin, and the carbon he steals from the closet where Gnix keeps the galvanic Lucifer. He brings them, plus a brick-sized crystal of hard glue and a blowtorch, back to the chapel, where everyone else is sleeping. Enlisted men are in the nave, as befits Marines who are basically a naval organization. Officers are in the transept. Chatton has the south arm of it all to himself. Waterhouse and Root and the SAS and USMC lieutenants have bunk beds in the north. A small moiety of Detachment 2702's astounding tarp supply has, then, been hung up across the eastern end of the place, partitioning off the chancel, Holy of Holies, where once the body and blood of Christ were housed. Now it contains a Helicrafter's Model S-27 15-tube super-heterodyne radio receiver, using state-of-the-art acorn tubes in its front end, capable of tuning VHF from 27 to 143 megahertz, and of receiving AM, FM, and CW, and including a signal strength meter which would come in handy if they were really operating a Huff-Duff station here, which they aren't. The lights are burning behind those tarps, and one of the Marines is snoring away in a chair in front of the altar. Waterhouse wakes him up and sends him to bed. The Marine is ashamed. He knows he was supposed to be awake, twiddling that antenna convincingly. The radio itself has hardly been used. They only turn it on when someone comes to visit who is not in on the secret. It sits there on the altar, pristine, as if it had just come from the Helicrafter's factory in Chicago, Illinois. All of the altar's fancy bits, if it ever had them, have long since succumbed to fire, rot, plunder, or the gnawing tusks of nest-building scaries. What remains is a rectangular monolith of basalt, featureless except for some marks from the tools that were used to quarry and shape it. It is a perfect foundation for tonight's experiment. Waterhouse gets the safe up there at some cost to the discs and ligaments in his lower back. It is tubular in shape, like an excerpt of naval gun barrel. He stands it up on its back end so that its round door with the round dial in the center is staring up at the ceiling like a blind eye, the radio lines on the dial looking very much like the striations of an iris. Behind that dial is a bunch of mechanical stuff that has gotten Waterhouse completely pissed off, driven him into a frantic state. By manipulating this dial in some way, he should be able to tease that mechanical stuff into some configuration that allows the door to be opened. That's all there is to it. That this door remains locked is an outrage. Why should the tiny volume inside this safe
much less than a single cubic foot, be so different from the space that Waterhouse moves through at will? What the hell is inside there? The glue looks like bad amber, flawed and bubbled, but still beautiful. He fires up the little blowtorch and plays the flame over one end of it. The glue softens, melts, and drips onto the floor of the safe, next to the dial, forming a little puddle about the size of a silver dollar. Working quickly, Waterhouse sets two single-edged razor blades into it, the blades dangerously upward-facing, parallel and somewhat less than an inch apart. He holds them in place for a few moments while the frigid metal of the safe sucks the heat out of that glue and makes it hard again. He has employed a pair of toothpicks as spacers to make sure that the blunt backs of the blades do not actually touch the door of the safe. He does not want an electrical connection between them. He solders a wire onto each of the razor blades and runs the wires across the altar toward the radio. Then he takes a little chunk of carbon and lays it across the two blades, forming a bridge between them. He tears open the back of the radio and does a bit of rewiring. Most of the rig is already set up the way he needs it. Basically, he's looking for something that will convert electrical impulses into sound and pump that sound into the headphones, which is what a radio does. But the source of the signal is no longer a transmitter on a U-boat, but rather the current flowing up one of Waterhouse's wires into the left razor blade, across the carbon bridge into the right razor blade, and back down the other wire. Getting this hooked up the way he wants it takes some doing. When he blunders down a blind alley and gets frustrated, he will go over and twiddle the antenna for a while, pretending to zero in on a U-boat. Then an idea will occur to him, and he will go back to work. Sometime around dawn, he hears a squeal from the headphones. A pair of Bakelite cups, bridged by a contraption that looks like a primitive surgical device, hooked up to the radio by a twisted pair of black and red wires. He turns the volume down and claps the phones over his head. He reaches out and lays one fingertip on the safe and hears a painful thud in his ears. He slides the fingertip over the surface of the cold metal and hears a rasping sound. Any vibrations cause the bridge of carbon to tremble on the razor blades, making and breaking the electrical connection, modulating the electrical current. The blades and the carbon are a microphone, and the microphone works almost too well. He takes his hand off the safe and just sits there and listens for a while. He can hear the footfalls of skerries going through the detachment's rations. He can hear the impact of waves on the shore miles away, and the thump of the taxi's bald tires on chuck holes out on the road.
Sounds like the taxi has a little alignment problem.
He can hear the scrub-scrub of Margaret cleaning the floor of the kitchen, and some minor arrhythmias in the heartbeats of the enlisted men, and the boom of glaciers calving on the coast of Iceland, and the squirrely drone of hastily machined propellers on approaching convoy ships. Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is plugged into the universe in a way that exceeds even what Bletchley Park has to offer. The center of that particular universe is the safe from U-553, and its axis passes up through the center of the dial, and now Waterhouse has his hand on it. He turns the volume way down before he touches anything so that he won't blow his eardrums out. The dial spins heavily but easily, as if mounted on gas bearings. Still, there is mechanical friction in there which is not perceptible to Waterhouse's admittedly frozen fingers, but which comes through in his earphones like a rock slide. When the tumblers move, it sounds like Waterhouse is shooting the main bolt on the gate of hell. It takes him a little while and a few more false starts to get his bearings. He doesn't know how many numbers are in the combination, or which way he should turn the dial to begin with. But with experimentation, some patterns begin to show through, and eventually he works out the following combination. 23 right, 37 left, 7 right, 31 left, 13 right. And then there's a really meaty click, and he knows in his marrow that he can take off the headphones. He spins a little wheel that is mounted on the front of the safe, adjacent to the dial. This withdraws the radial dogs that have been holding the door shut. He hauls the door up, careful not to slash his hand on the twin razors and looks into the safe. His feeling of disappointment that accompanies this action has nothing to do with the contents of the safe. He is disappointed because he has solved the problem and has gone back to the baseline state of boredom and low-level irritation that always comes over him when he's not doing something that inherently needs to be done, like picking a lock or breaking a code. He sticks his arm all the way down to the bottom of the safe and finds a metal object about the size of a hot dog bun. He knew it would be there because, like children investigating wrapped presents in the days before Christmas, they had been tilting the safe this way and that, and when they did, they heard something sliding from one end to the other, going ding-dong, ding-dong, and wondered what it was. This object is so cold and sucks the heat out of his hands so efficiently that it hurts to touch it. He shakes his hand to bring circulation back, then grasps the thing, yanks it out briskly, and throws it down on the altar. It bounces once, twice, in a seesawing motion, and rings piercingly as it does. The closest thing to a musical sound that has shaken the air of this chapel in many centuries. It shines gaudily under the electric lights they have set up around the chancel. The glittering light catches the eye of Waterhouse, who has been living on gray and cloudy tagum for weeks, wearing and sleeping in things that are black or khaki or olive drab. He is mesmerized by this thing, simply because of its brightness and beauty against the dull and rude basalt, even before his mind identifies it as a bar of solid gold. It makes a heck of a paperweight, which is a good thing because the chapel is nothing if not drafty, and the important contents of the safe consist of onion-skin pages that fly away in the tiniest breeze. The pages are ruled with faint horizontal and vertical lines, dividing each one into a grid, and the grids are filled in with hand-printed letters in groups of five.
"Wow, look what you found," says a quiet voice.
Waterhouse looks up into the unsettlingly calm and placid gaze of Enoch Root.
"Yes, encrypted messages," Waterhouse says. "Non-enigma."
"Now," Root says, "I was referring to the root of all evil here."
He tries to pick up the gold bar, but his fingers merely slip off of it. He gets a firmer grip and hefts it up off the altar. Something about it catches his eye, and he turns to bring it under one of the electric lights, frowning at it with the critical intensity of a diamond cutter.
"It's got Hazzy characters stamped on it," Root says.
"Beg pardon?"
"Chinese or Japanese. Nah, Chinese. There's the chop of a bank in Shanghai. And here are some figures, the fineness and the serial number."
Showing unexpected familiarity with such matters for a missionary priest. Until this point, the gold bar has signified nothing to Waterhouse. It's just a bulk sample of a chemical element like a lead weight or a flask of mercury. But the fact that it might convey information is quite interesting. He absolutely has to stand up and go look at it. Root is correct. The bar has been neatly marked with small oriental characters applied with a stamp. The tiny facets of the ideograms glitter under the light, sparks jumping the gap between the two halves of the axis. Root sets the gold bar down on the altar. He saunters over to a table where they keep stationery and pulls out a sheet of onion skin and a fresh pencil. Returning to the altar, he lays the frail page over the top of the gold bar, then rubs the side of the pencil lead back and forth over it, turning it all black except for where the stamped numbers and characters are underneath. Within a few moments, he has a perfect little rubbing, showing the inscription in full detail. He folds the page up and pockets it, then returns the pencil to the table. Waterhouse has long since gone back to his examination of the pages from the safe. The numbers are all written in the same hand. Now, since they dredged all manner of other paperwork out of the sewage sloshing through the U-boat skipper's cabin, Waterhouse can recognize the captain's hand easily enough. These sheets were written by someone else. The format of the messages makes it clear that they were not encrypted with an Enigma machine. Enigma messages always begin with two groups of three letters each,
which tell the receiving clerk how to set the wheels on his machine. Those groups are missing on all of these sheets, so some other cipher system must have been used. Like every other modern nation, the Germans have a plethora of different cipher systems, some based on books and some on machines. Bletchley Park has broken most of them. Still, it looks like an interesting exercise. Now that the rest of Detachment 2702 has arrived, making further trysts with Margaret impractical, Waterhouse has nothing to look forward to. Trying to crack the code used on these sheets will be a perfect puzzle to fill the gaping void that opened up as soon as Waterhouse broke the combination of the safe. He steals some paper of his own, sits down at the desk, and busies himself for an hour or two copying out the ciphertext from the skipper's pages, double and triple-checking each code group to make sure he's got an accurate copy. On the one hand, this is a pain in the ass. On the other, it gives him a chance to go through the ciphertext by hand at the very lowest level, which might be useful later. The ineffable talent for finding patterns in chaos cannot do its thing unless he immerses himself in the chaos first. If they do contain patterns, he does not see them just now in any rational way, but there may be some sub-rational part of his mind that can go to work now that the letters have passed before his eyes and through his pencil, and they may suddenly present him with a gift-wrapped clue, or even a full solution, a few weeks from now while he is shaving or antenna-twiddling. He has been dimly aware for a while that Chatton and the others are awake now. Enlisted men are not allowed into the chancel, but the officers get to gather round and admire the gold bar.
"Breaking the code, Waterhouse,"
Chatton says, ambling over to the desk, warming his hands with a mug of coffee.
"Making a clean copy,"
Waterhouse says, and then, because he is not without a certain cunning, adds, "In case the originals are destroyed in transit."
"Very prudent,"
Chatton nods.
"Say, you didn't hide a second gold bar anywhere, did you?"
Waterhouse has been in the military long enough that he does not rise to the bait. The pattern of sounds made when we tilted the safe back and forth indicated that there was only a single heavy object inside, sir. Chatton chuckles and takes a sip of his coffee.
"I shall be interested to see whether you can break that cipher, Lieutenant Waterhouse. I am tempted to put money on it."
"I sure appreciate that, but it would be a lousy bet, sir,"
Waterhouse replies.
"The chances are very good that Bletchley Park has already broken this cipher, whatever it may be."
"Oh, what makes you say that?"
Chatton asks, absently. The question is so silly, coming from a man in Chatton's position, that it leaves Waterhouse disoriented.
"Sir, Bletchley Park has broken nearly all of the German military and governmental codes."
Chatton makes a face of mock disappointment.
"Waterhouse, how unscientific! You are making assumptions!"
Waterhouse thinks back and tries to work out the meaning of this.
"You think that this cipher might not be German, or that it might not be military or governmental?"
"I am merely cautioning you against making assumptions," Chatton says.
Waterhouse is still thinking this one over as they are approached by Lieutenant Robson, the commanding officer of the SAS squad.
"Sir,"
he says,
"for the benefit of the fellows down in London, we would like to know the combination."
"The combination?" Waterhouse asks blankly.
This word, devoid of context, could mean almost anything.
"Yes, sir,"
Robson says precisely.
"To the safe."
"Oh,"
Waterhouse says. He is faintly irritated that they would ask him this question. There seems little point in writing down the combination when the equipment needed to break into the safe is sitting right there. It is much more important to have a safe-breaking algorithm than to have one particular solution to a safe-breaking problem.
"I don't know," he says. "I forgot."
"You forgot," Chatton says.
He says it on behalf of Robson, who appears to be violently biting his tongue.
"Did you perhaps write it down before you forgot it?"
"No,"
Waterhouse says. "But I remember that it consists entirely of prime numbers."
"Well, that narrows it down,"
Chatton says cheerfully. Robson does not seem mollified, though. "And there are five numbers in all, which is interesting since five itself is a prime number," Chatton says.
Once again, Waterhouse is pleased to see his commanding officer displaying signs of a tasteful and expensive education.
"Very well,"
Robson announces through clenched teeth.
"I shall inform the recipients."
Sultan. The Grand Wazir of Kinakuta leads them into the offices of his boss, the Sultan, and leaves them alone for a few minutes at one corner of the conference table, to build which a whole species of tropical hardwoods had to be extinguished. After that, it is a race among the founders of Epiphyte Corp to see who can blurt out the first witticism about the size of the Sultan's home office deduction. They are in the new palace, three arms of which wrap around the exotic gardens of the ancient and magnificent old palace. The meeting room has a 10-meter-high ceiling. The walls, facing onto the garden, are made entirely of glass, so the effect is like looking into a terrarium that contains a model of a sultan's palace. Randy has never known much about architecture, and his vocabulary fails him abjectly. The best he could say is that it's sort of like a cross between the Taj Mahal and Angkor Wat. To get here, they had to drive down a long boulevard of palm trees, enter a huge vaulted marble entrance hall, submit to metal detection and frisking, sit in an anteroom for a while sipping tea, take their shoes off, have warm rose water poured over their hands by a turbaned servant wielding an ornate ewer, and then walk across about half a mile of polished marble and oriental carpets. As soon as the door wafts shut behind the Grand Wazir's ass, Avi says, "I smell a con job."
"A con job?" Randy scoffs.
"Why, you think this is a rear-screen projection? You think this table is made of formica?"
"It's all real," Avi admits sourly. "But whenever someone gives you the treatment like this, it's because they're trying to impress you."
"I'm impressed," Randy says. "I admit it, I'm impressed."
"That's just a euphemism for, I'm about to do something moronic," Avi says.
"What are we going to do? This isn't the kind of meeting where anything actually gets done, is it?"
"If you mean, are we going to sign contracts, is money going to change hands, then no, nothing is going to get done, but plenty is going to happen."
The door opens again, and the Grand Wazir leads a group of Nipponese men into the room. Avi lowers his voice.
"Just remember that, at the end of the day, we're back in the hotel, and the Sultan is still here, and all of this is just a memory to us. The fact that the Sultan has a big garden has no relevance to anything."
Randy starts to get irked. This is so obvious, it's insulting to mention it. But part of the reason he's irked is because he knows Avi saw right through him. Avi's always telling him not to be romantic, but he wouldn't be here doing this if not for the romance. Which leads to the question, why is Avi doing it? Maybe he has some romantic delusions of his own, carefully concealed. Maybe that's why he can see through Randy so damn well. Maybe Avi is cautioning himself as much as he is the other members of Epiphyte Corp. Actually, this new group is not Nipponese, but Chinese, probably from Taiwan. The Grand Wazir shows them their assigned seats, which are far enough away that they could exchange sporadic gunfire with Epiphyte Corp, but not converse without the aid of bullhorns. They spend a minute or so pretending to give a shit about the gardens and the old palace. Then, a compact, powerfully built man in his 50s pivots towards Epiphyte Corp and strides over to them, dragging out a skein of aids. Randy's reminded of a computer simulation he saw once of a black hole passing through a galaxy and training a retinue of stars. Randy recognizes the man's face vaguely. It has been printed in business journals more than once, but not often enough for Randy to remember his name. If Randy were something other than a hacker, he'd have to step forward now and deal with protocol issues. He'd be stressed out and hating it. But thank God all that shit devolves automatically on Avi, who steps up to meet this Taiwanese guy. They shake hands and go through the rote exchange of business cards, but the Chinese guy is looking straight through Avi, checking out the other Epiphyte people. Finding Randy wanting, he moves on to Eberhard Fuhr.
Which one is Cantrell? He says.
John's leaning against the window, probably trying to figure out what parametric equation generated the petals on that 8-foot-tall carnivorous plant. He turns around to be introduced.
John Cantrell? Harvard Lee. Didn't you get my email?
Harvard Lee. Now Randy is starting to remember this guy. Founder of Harvard Computer Company, a medium-sized PC clone manufacturer in Taiwan. John grins.
I received about 20 email messages from an unknown person claiming to be Harvard Lee. Those were from me. I do not understand what you mean that I am an unknown person.
Harvard Lee is extremely brisk, but not exactly pissed off. He is, Randy realizes, not the kind of man who has to coach himself not to be romantic before a meeting.
I hate email, John says.
Harvard Lee stares him in the eye for a while.
What do you mean?
Well, the concept is good. The execution is poor. People don't observe any security precautions.
A message arrives claiming to be from Harvard Lee. They believe it's really from Harvard Lee, but this message is just a pattern of magnetized spots on a spinning disk somewhere. Anyone could forge it.
You use digital signature algorithm.
John considers this carefully.
I do not respond to any email that is not digitally signed. Digital signature algorithm refers to one technique for signing them. It is a good technique, but it could be better.
Harvard Lee begins nodding about halfway through this, acknowledging the point.
Is there a structural problem? Or are you concerned by the 512-bit key length? Would it be acceptable with a 1024-bit key?
About 3 sentences later, the conversation between Cantrell and Lee soars over the horizon of Randy's cryptographic knowledge, and his brain shuts down. Harvard Lee is a cryptomaniac. He has been studying this shit personally, not just paying minions to read the books and send him notes, but personally going over the equations, doing the math.
Tom Howard is grinning broadly.
Eberhard is looking about as amused as he ever gets, and Beryl's biting back a grin. Randy is trying desperately to get the joke. Avi notes the confusion on Randy's face, turns his back to the Taiwanese, and rubs his thumb and fingers together. Money. Oh, yeah. It had to be something to do with that. Harvard Lee cranked out a few million PC clones in the early 90s and loaded them all with Windows, Word, and Excel. But somehow forgot to write any checks to Microsoft. About a year ago, Microsoft kicked his ass in court and won a huge judgment. Harvard claimed bankruptcy. He doesn't have a penny to his name. Microsoft has been trying to prove he still has the odd billion or two salted away. Harvard Lee has clearly been thinking very hard about how to put money where guys like Microsoft can't get it. There are many time-honored ways. The Swiss bank account, the false front corporation, the big real estate project in deepest, darkest China, bars of gold in a vault somewhere. Those tricks might work with the average government, but Microsoft is 10 times smarter, 100 times more aggressive, and bound by no particular rules. It gives Randy a little frisson just to imagine Harvard Lee's situation, being chased across the planet by Microsoft's state-of-the-art hellhounds. Harvard Lee needs electronic cash, not the lame stuff that people use to buy T-shirts on the web without giving away their credit card numbers. He needs the full-on badass kind, based on hard crypto, rooted in an offshore data haven, and he needs it bad. So nothing's more logical than that he is sending lots of email to John Cantrell. Tom Howard sidles up to him.
The question is it just Harvard Lee, or does he think he's discovered a new market?
Probably both, Randy guesses. He probably knows a few other people who'd like to have a private bank.
The missiles,
Tom says. Yeah. China's been taking pot shots at Taiwan with ballistic missiles lately, sort of like a Wild West villain shooting at the good guy's feet to make him dance.
There have been bank runs in Taipei.
In a way,
Tom says,
these guys are tons smarter than us,
because they've never had a currency they could depend on.
He and Randy look over at John Cantrell, who has crossed his arms over his chest and is unloading a disquisition on the Euler totient function, while Harvard Lee nods intently and his nerd de camp frantically scrawls notes on a legal pad. Avi stands far to one side, staring at the old palace, as in his mind, the ramifications of this bloom and sprawl and twine about each other like a tropical garden run riot. Other delegations file into the room behind the Grand Wazir and stake out chunks of the conference table's coastline. The dentist comes in with his Norns or Furies or hygienists or whatever the hell they are. There's a group of white guys talking in down-underish accents. Other than that, they are all Asians. Some of them talk amongst themselves, and some pull on their chins and watch the conversation between Harvard Lee and John Cantrell. Randy watches them in turn. Bad suit Asians and good suit Asians. The former have grizzled buzz cuts and nicotine-tanned skin and look like killers. They are wearing bad suits, not because they can't afford good ones, but because they don't give a shit. They are from China. The good suit Asians have high-maintenance haircuts, eyeglasses from Paris, clear skin, ready smiles. They are mostly from Nippon.
I want to exchange keys right now so we can email, Lee says,
and gestures to an aide who scurries to the edge of the table and unfolds a laptop.
Something, something, Ordo, Lee says in Cantonese.
The aide points and clicks. Cantrell is gazing at the table expressionlessly. He squats down to look under it. He strolls over and feels under the edge with his hand. Randy bends and looks too. It's one of these high-tech conference tables with embedded power and communications lines so that visitors can plug in their laptops without having to string unsightly cables around and fight over power outlets. The slab must be riddled with conduits. No visible wires connect it to the world. The connections must run down hollow legs and into a hollow floor. John grins, turns to Lee, and shakes his head.
Normally I'd say fine, he says. But for a client with your level of security needs, this is not an acceptable place to exchange keys.
I'm not planning on using the phone, Lee says.
We can exchange them on floppies.
John knocks on wood.
Doesn't matter. Have one of your staff look into the subject of Van Eck Freakin. That's with a PH, not an F, he says to the aide who's writing it down.
Then, sensing Lee's need for an executive summary, he says,
They can read the internal state of your computer by listening to the faint radio emissions coming out of the chips.
Ah,
Lee says, and exchanges hugely significant looks with his technical aides, as if this explains something that has been puzzling the shit out of them. Someone begins hollering wildly at the far end of the room, not the end by which the guests entered, but the other one. It is a chap in a get-up similar to, but not quite as ornate as the Grand Wazir's. At some point, he switches to English, the same dialect of English spoken by flight attendants for foreign airlines, who have told passengers to insert the metal tongue into the buckle so many times that it rushes out in one phlegmy garble. Small Kinnikutan men in good suits begin filing into the room. They take seats across the head end of the table, which is wide enough for a Last Supper tableau. In the Jesus position is a really big chair. It is the kind of thing you'd get if you went to a Finnish designer with a shaved head, rimless glasses, and twin PhDs in semiotics and civil engineering, wrote him a blank check, and asked him to design a throne. Behind is a separate table for minions. All of it is backed up by tons of priceless artwork. An eroded frieze, amputated from a jungle ruin somewhere. All the guests gravitate instinctively towards their positions around the table and remain standing. The Grand Wazir glares at each one in turn. A small man slips into the room, staring vacantly at the floor in front of him, seemingly unaware that other people are present. His hair is lacquered down to his skull, his appearance of portliness minimized by Savile Row legerdemain. He eases into the big chair, which seems like a shocking violation of etiquette until Randy realizes that this is the Sultan.
Suddenly, everyone is sitting down. Randy pulls his chair back and falls into it. The leathery depths swallow his ass like a catcher's mitt accepting a baseball. He's about to pull his laptop out of its bag, but in this setting, both the nylon bag and the plastic computer have a strip mall tawdriness. Besides, he has to resist this sophomoric tendency to take notes all the time. Abby himself said that nothing was going to happen at this meeting. All the important stuff is going to be subtextual. Besides, there is the matter of Van Eck freaking, which Cantrell probably mentioned just to make Harvard Lee paranoid, but which has Randy a bit rattled, too. He opts for a pad of graph paper, the engineer's answer to the legal pad, and a fine-point disposable pen. The Sultan has an Oxford English accent, with traces of garlic and red pepper still wedged in its teeth. He speaks for about 15 minutes. The room contains a few dozen living bodies, each one a big sack of guts and fluids, so highly compressed that it will squirt for a few yards when pierced. Each one is built around an armature of 206 bones connected to each other by notoriously fault-prone joints that are given to obnoxious creaking, grinding, and popping noises when they are in other than pristine condition. This structure is draped with throbbing steak, inflated with clenching air sacs, and pierced by a Gordian sewer filled with burbling acid and compressed gas, and a squirt with vile enzymes and solvents produced by the many dark, gamey nuggets of genetically programmed meat strung along its length. Slugs of dissolving food are forced down this sloppy labyrinth by serialized convulsions, decaying into gas, liquid, and solid matter, which must all be regularly vented to the outside world, lest the owner go toxic and drop dead. Spherical, gel-packed cameras swivel in mucus-greased ball joints. Infinite phalanxes of cilia beat back invading particles, encapsulate them in goo for later disposal. In each body, a centrally located muscle flails away at an eternal circulating torrent of pressurized gravy. And yet, despite all of this, not one of these bodies makes a single sound at any time during the Sultan's speech. It is a marvel that can only be explained by the power of brain over body, and in turn by the power of cultural conditioning over the brain. Their host is trying to be appropriately sultanic, providing vision and direction without getting sucked down into the quicksand of management. The basic vision, or so it seems at first, is that Kinakuta has always been a crossroads, a meeting place of cultures, the original Malays, Foot and his dynasty of white sultans, Filipinos with their Spanish, American, and Nipponese governors to the east, Muslims to the west, Anglos to the south, numerous Southeast Asian cultures to the north, Chinese everywhere as usual, Nipponese whenever they are in one of their adventurous moods, and, for what it's worth, the Neolithic tribesmen who inhabit the interior of the island. Hence, nothing is more natural than that the present-day Kinakutans should run big fat optical fiber cables in every direction, patch into every major national telco within reach, and become a sort of digital bazaar. All of the guests nod soberly at the Sultan's insight, his masterful ability to meld the ancient ways of his country with modern technology. But this is nothing more than a superficial analogy, the Sultan confesses. Everyone nods somewhat more vigorously than they did before. Indeed, everything that the Sultan was just saying was, in fact, horseshit. Several people jot down notes, lest they lose the Sultan's thread. After all, the Sultan says, physical location no longer matters in a digitized, networked world. Cyberspace knows no boundaries. Everyone nods vigorously except for, on the one hand, John Cantrell, and on the other, the grizzled Chinese guys. But hey, the Sultan continues, that's just dizzy-headed cyber cheerleading. What bullshit. Of course locations and boundaries matter. At this point, the room is plunged into dimness as the light pouring in through the window wall is throttled by some kind of invisible mechanism built into the glass. Liquid crystal shutters or something. Screens descend from slots cunningly hidden in the room's ceiling.
This diversion saves the cervical vertebrae of many guests who are about to whiplash themselves by nodding even more vigorously at the Sultan's latest hairpin turn. God damn it, does location matter in cyberspace or doesn't it? What's the bottom line here? This isn't some Oxford debating society. Get to the point. The Sultan's whipping some graphics on them. A map of the world in one of those politically correct projections that makes America and Europe look like ice-bound reefs in the high Arctic. A pattern of straight lines is superimposed on the map, each joining two major cities. The web of lines gets denser and denser as the Sultan talks, nearly obscuring the land masses and the oceans as well. This, the Sultan explains, is the conventional understanding of the Internet, a decentralized web connecting each place with all the other places with no bottlenecks or, if you will, choke points. But it's more bullshit. A new graphic comes up. Same map, different pattern of lines. Now we have webs within countries, sometimes within continents. But between countries, and especially between continents, there are only a few lines. It's not web-like at all. Randy looks at Cantrell, who's nodding slyly.
Many net partisans are convinced that the net is robust because its lines of communication are spread evenly across the planet. In fact, as you can see from this graphic, nearly all intercontinental web traffic passes through a small number of choke points. Typically, these choke points are controlled and monitored by local governments. Clearly, then, any Internet application that wants to stand free of governmental interference is undermined from the very beginning by a fundamental structure problem.
Free of governmental interference? Randy can't believe he's hearing this. If the Sultan was a scruffy hacker talking to a room full of crypto-anarchists, that'd be one thing. But the Sultan is a government, for God's sake, and the room is full of card-carrying establishment types. Like those Chinese buzzcuts. Who the hell are they? Don't try to tell Randy those guys aren't part of the Chinese government in some sense.
Bottlenecks are only one of the structural barriers to the creation of a free, sovereign, location-independent cyberspace. The Sultan continues blithely.
Sovereign?
Another is the heterogeneous patchwork of laws and indeed of legal systems that address privacy, free speech, and telecoms policy.
Another map graphic appears. Each country is colored, shaded, and patterned according to a scheme of intimidating complexity. A half-assed stab at explaining it is made by a complex legend underneath. Instant migraine. That, of course, is the whole point.
The policy of any given legal system toward privacy issues is typically the result of incremental changes made over centuries by courts and legislative bodies, the Sultan says. With all due respect, very little of it is relevant to modern privacy issues.
The lights come back on. Sun waxes through the windows. The screens disappear silently into the ceiling, and everyone's mildly surprised to see that the Sultan is on his feet. He is approaching a large and, of course, ornate and expensive-looking go-board covered with a complex pattern of black and white stones.
Perhaps I can make an analogy to Go, though chess would work just as well. Because of our history, we Kinakutans are well-versed in both games. At the beginning of the game, the pieces are arranged in a pattern that is simple and easy to understand. But the game evolves. The players make small decisions, one turn at a time, each decision fairly simple in and of itself, and made for reasons that can be easily understood even by a novice. But over the course of many such turns, the pattern develops such great complexity that only the finest minds or the finest computers can comprehend it.
The Sultan is gazing down thoughtfully at the go-board as he says this. He looks up and starts making eye contact around the room.
The analogy is clear. Our policies concerning free speech, telecommunications, and cryptography have evolved from a series of simple, rational decisions, but they are today so complex that no one can understand them, even in one single country, to say nothing of all countries taken together.
The Sultan pauses and walks broodingly around the go-board. The guests have mostly given up on the obsequious nodding and jotting by this point. No one is being tactical now.
They are all listening with genuine interest, wondering what he's going to say next. But he says nothing. Instead, he lays one arm across the board and with a sudden violent motion sweeps all the stones aside. They rain down into the carpet, skitter across polished stone, clatter onto the tabletop. There is a silence of at least 15 seconds. The Sultan looks stony. Then suddenly, he brightens up.
"Time to start over," he says. "A very difficult thing to do in a large country, where laws are written by legislative bodies, interpreted by judges, bound by ancient precedents. But this is the Sultanate of Kinakuta, and I am the Sultan, and I say that the law here is to be very simple. Total freedom of information. I hereby abdicate all government power over the flow of data across and within my borders. Under no circumstances will any part of this government snoop on information flows or use its power to in any way restrict such flows. That is the new law of Kinakuta. I invite you gentlemen to make the most of it. Thank you."